Yes, today is April 5. Thank you very much, everyone, reminding me of the date. And it's Monday, and we're just going to be finished. We're going to get as far as we can into histamine, and then we're done. We're going to be done with histamine today, and we're going to go on to the cancer stuff. I'll start that on Monday. I'll put up PowerPoint slides today or tomorrow, so have them printed out when you come on Wednesday, chapter 1 of the cancer section. I think you'll find the cancer section to be extremely interesting. I'm sorry we're not going to get as far along as we could, but it's an eye-opening experience, and I know of some people who are interested in going into cancer research because of their experience here. So, we have now, if we look at the schedule, which I glanced at but didn't print out, I think we have about 2 weeks before, two full weeks before final, before the week before final. Does that make sense? I think in terms of Mondays, this is April, today is April 5, we have April 12, we have April 19. And then April 26th, I think, April 26th is finals, is that right? And then May 2 is graduation. According to policy, you're not supposed to have any tests during the week prior to finals. So we can't have a test here and here. So we just finished a test on, what is it, the 2nd?
Yes.
There's a test here. So we're going to have a test, a test over whatever we cover, starting with a little bit of chapter 13. Is that right? Because we didn't get through all the way into chapter 13. So this next test will be, if this is the 12th, then Tuesday's the 13th, Wednesday's the 14th. 15th, 16th. So there's going to be a test on the 16th. I don't know what's on the schedule, but that's what we're going to have. Well, what do you know? Life is amazingly good. We kind of stumble across this at times. Now, so today is going to be the last part of histamine. And then on the let's see, the 5, this is 6, and then 7. Now, if you recall, you owe me a little bit of extra time. Is that right in terms of lecture? But we can't do it on Monday and Friday. Is that right? Because you have a Monday-Friday conflict. Who has a Monday-Friday conflict but no Wednesday conflict?
Well, I have work on Monday.
Oh, okay. Congratulations. Nice conflict. This is why it's almost impossible to get a group of 5 together in this place, isn't it? To have a single time which all 5 people can meet. So what I'd like to do is, not to make this too extreme, but on this week and next week, I'd like to start at 8 a.m. on Wednesday. Okay, can we do that? Could you put that in?
Yes, we can do that.
Excellent, good. Now then, I don't know about this. We'll figure that out. I don't know if we'll do that on, what would that be, the 21st? And, of course, there won't be happening anything during the finals. So.
I got a question regarding the final.
Yes.
Is it going to be a standardized exam, or are you just going to make up
that? It'll be a standardized exam. Okay. It'll be almost all, it will be exactly over biochemistry. Unfortunately, it won't have any neurochemistry, and it won't have any of the cancer stuff in it.
Yeah. Basically
correct. That's why this test is relatively important. During this last week, I don't know, I may look at some cancer, but I also may give us a quick review on some molecular biology concepts. Because there's like 6-7 questions on the final, on Saturday's final, about molecular biology issues, DNA, RNA, transcription, translation, this kind of thing. So I may take some time during this week right here So today is going to be, histamine, then we have cancer, and then we'll probably have a little bit of cancer, and maybe probably the last 2 days. Is Friday a dead day?
I
think so. I think it is, isn't it? So we even have less time than it looks right here. So at any rate, it's all good. We've had a full class. I mean, I don't think you're going to complain about the amount of material that you were expected to know. Is that correct? I mean, it was reasonably content-filled. It's fine. All right. It's good. And I'd like to congratulate Ken. This Sunday he was baptized. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Outstanding. Congratulations, Ken. Excellent choice. Good decision. May God richly bless you because of your choice to his commitment. Commitment to him and his ideals. I certainly can tell you, though, as you get older, you begin to realize what a gift grace is. When you're young and enthusiastic and battling against the forces that can confound you every day, it's a wonderful thing. But life can sometimes tell you that you're not as strong as you think you are. And I become strongest the more I lean on Christ. And that's absolutely the way it is, no doubt about it. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you for the celebration that we have in remembrance of your death and resurrection. The most significant event that has happened on this earth other than its very creation. Lord, thank you so much. Because of the gift it gives us, it gives us hope, Lord. It gives us optimism, a sense that no matter what happens in this life, no matter what the devil has in store for us, no matter how much he battles against us, he is defeated already. And that we can look forward with confidence every day, knowing that we can be optimistic about that day, that our future is assured. Whether our life is cut short unexpectedly or we live a good long life, we know after that life comes the best yet to be. Thank you, Lord, for loving us and for giving us parents and friends and family and relationships that stimulate us and support us and lift us up during the hard times and laugh with us during the good times. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, I think we were partway through histamine, and we're going to get through as far as we can. I think we were looking at the synthesis of it, is that right? And histamine, of course, is one of the four major neurotransmitters that we're exploring this semester. It's going to be the last one. I know I handed out a segment about stroke. We're simply not going to be able to get to that today or this semester. There won't be any questions over it. I won't have any expectation that you know anything about it. All right. Good. So when we look at the histamine synthesis again, it's very, very straightforward. I'm going to expect you to know certainly the one-step synthesis, the structure of histidine and the structure of histamine, of course, and I wanted you to know the various tags or classifications for the various nitrogens. There are three nitrogens here. They're given specific terms or classifications or tags or labels, and I need for you to know that. Don't worry about the breakdown processes, except to know that the most common breakdown product is this imidazole acetic acid. That's the most common one, and that's the one that really is the deactivated form of histamine. We know that MAO, which plays a role in the breakdown of what other neurotransmitter?
Serotonin,
that's correct. Also plays an isoform of this, called the B version, MAOB, plays some part of a role in the breakdown of histamine, but it's not the most common form. Other forms of MAOB is. Now, the IAA is, again, like I said, one of the most prominent ones. But in vertebrate tissue, which is, I guess, what we are, it turns out that the breakdown product turns out to be all methylated. So in vertebrates, so this would be theoretically a good target if you wanted to whack some insects or whatever on this imidazole acetic acid. But let's go on. IAA is a GABA agonist. Now, what that means is, that the neurotransmitter GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, its receptors can also bind to IAA, or actually IAA binds to those GABA receptors, and therefore turns those receptors on. That's what is meant by an agonist. It actually binds and has a similar effect to normal GABA. Let's take a look at histamine. Histamine cannot pass through the blood-brain barrier, but L-histidine can. The HDC is not saturated. So if you get excessive levels of histidine, it can raise the histamine levels in the brain. And the last comment is, since it can't pass through the blood-brain barrier, L-His can, well, this is a highly polarized compound. And so it has to be transported through the membrane. And so, as it says here, is transported using a transporter system. So the materials there, there is a transporter for it. Next thing is, this is a very interesting diagram here. Got all kinds of interesting compounds with it. And you see some outliers that say something that we need to be aware of. And so I'm literally going to just talk about this diagram and its caption. So, relationship between lipid solubility and brain uptake of selected compounds. In other words, this brain uptake means how well it penetrates through the blood-brain barrier. What they look at is the distribution into octanol relative to water for each test substance serves as a measure of lipid solubility. So this oil-water partition coefficient divided by the square root of molecular weight. I have no idea how they came up with this, but apparently this is a logarithmic scale. Notice a logarithmic scale. And I don't know the theory whereby they use the term dividing by the molecular weight, square root of the molecular weight. But is everybody familiar with the oil-water partition coefficient, or what that means? Oil-water partition coefficient. It literally means this: you take a SEP funnel. At least this is what would happen in a gross sense. They may have a more sophisticated methodology than this, but. They take a SEP funnel and water in it. You got some octanol. Or is it octanol? Yeah, octanol. Octanol, which essentially is not all that water soluble, but it is does have some polarity with it. And they put these compounds in it. And you shake it up. And so you have some of the compound goes in water. Some of the compound stays or goes into the octanol, and then you measure the relative concentration. The concentration here in H2O, and then you got the concentration here in octanol, and then literally you like divide the two. And what that does is this gives you the partition coefficient. So in other words, since it's oil-water partition coefficient, that means they look at how well it goes into oil versus water. So So the division here is actually octanol divided by water. You know, octanol concentration divided by water. That's why they say it's the oil-water partition coefficient. You get some value here. Apparently, you divide it by the molecular weight and you plot it on a logarithmic scale versus its brain uptake rate, the rate, how well it crosses the blood-brain barrier, and you get this amazingly linear. Linear. There's got to be a theory why that happens the way it does, but anyway. So you can see here that there's a pretty nice relationship between if the oil-water partition coefficient. What this means is, let's take a look at it. You got L-glucose right here. Now, what's the difference between L-glucose and D-glucose? In terms of... Flipped. What's the word? Isomers, but they're a particular kind of isomer. What are they? Stereoisomers. One's left-handed and one's right-handed. Which one do you consume and which one can you use for food? L-glucose or D-glucose? D-glucose. Exactly correct. So, in other words, that these two things have identical physical characteristics except for one thing. What one physical characteristic that you can measure, is it different? Are those two things different? How can you distinguish between the two? The one physical characteristic. The way they rotate plane polarized light, that's exactly right. What is the fancy term for that? Exactly. But there is a broad term for dextro and levo and all that. What's it called? Optical activity. Very optical polarity. Yes, that would work as well. Optical activity and polarity. Well, that's interesting. Somebody was so desperate to get out of class, they decided to climb through the window. That's interesting. Okay, well, at any rate. So what this means is this L-glucose relatively soluble in oil or not relatively soluble in oil? Soluble in oil or not soluble in oil? Is it going to partition in the oil or stay in the water? It's going to stay in the water. Exactly correct. So the amount of it in oil versus water means that since it's way down here, there's very little of it in oil versus how much of it went into water. So that's why its partition coefficient is relatively low. Over here, look at ethanol. Ethanol, look at that. Notice it has a relatively high oil-water partition coefficient, almost identical to water. You can imagine. In other words, there is a little bit of water that goes into the oil. Turns out there's more water that goes in the oil than L-glucose. But at any rate, so... So you have L-glucose, which gives us a physical... So what in the world... Why would L-glucose go into the brain relatively slowly and not be oil-soluble? But notice, glucose has the same solubility, right? The same partition coefficient. But it gets transported in, or is uptaken... at a much greater rate. Again, this is also a logarithmic scale, so that's 1, 2, 3. Looks like nearly three decades or 1,000 times more likely brought up. Why is this one actually brought up more? Why is it uptaken? Why does it have a greater rate? I'll tell you, because it's being transported by a protein transporter. It's being transported. So there's a transporter for D-glucose. And then you look at other outliers here that have these square dots, L-leucine, L-dope. I wonder what that means. since it's being transported at a rate greater than what its partition coefficient would indicate, is what? See? The higher the uptake, the greater the productivity. Uptake of two anticonvulsants is lower than predicted from the lipid solubility, partly because their binding is to plasma proteins. Uptake of D-glucose, D-leucine, and L-DOPA is greater than predicted by their lipid solubility because specific carriers facilitate their transport across the brain capillary. So phenobarb and phenytoin, these two compounds are actually less than what you might suspect from their partition coefficient because they're bound to stuff in the blood and therefore don't move across the blood-brain barrier according to what you would predict from their oil-water partition coefficient. So the more oil-soluble it is, the more likely it is to get across the blood-brain barrier. So notice here, nicotine has some facility in getting across the oil, the blood-brain barrier. And heroin also has some facility getting across the blood-brain barrier, whereas ethanol is slightly less. Now, but ethanol, interestingly enough, ethanol does not provide the psychological effects that people would like it to have or drink it to have. In other words, it's not the actual ethanol that provides the buzz that people want when they drink alcohol. It's the aldehyde version of it. It's the acetaldehyde that provides the drunkenness or the freedom from relaxed nature or whatever. Which is actually, it turns out to be, it's the acetaldehyde that's the central nervous system depressant, essentially what it is. Okay, so here you see these various things, and transport rate, the rate here is in nanomoles per gram per minute, determined rates, normal plasma. So here you see hexose, a very high transport rate, lactate, a high transport rate, some of these others are relatively high. You get the sodium as a good transport. Of course, all this is occurring because of the sodium, potassium, ATPase pumps, so on. And these adenines, adenosines, a very, very low rate of transport. They don't have any stuff for that. So high rates of transport mean that it's being pumped across. Four. Now, how much of this do you have to write down? Do you have to write down most of it? Not a whole lot of it, but some of it, because I don't have a whole lot here. All right, so how is histamine stored and released? This is page 4 of the handout, histamine storage and release. It's stored in synaptic vesicles, just like the classic acetylcholine. It's released upon voltage-dependent and calcium-dependent action, so that means that the action potential comes along and can directly release it, or it can also open up the voltage-gated calcium channels and allow calcium to come in and whack it. Not whack it, but fuse the vesicles to that. Histamine reuptake. Apparently there is none. So how does it get... how does it get where it goes? How does it then get broken down? Following its release, histamine is methylated from SAM using HMT, which we just described earlier as probably being the most important vertebrate pathway for its degradation. But a variety of materials can inhibit HMT. The product, in other words, it's a feedback inhibited. The substrate itself can inhibit histamine. You don't need to know the other compounds. We just don't even fill that in. It's okay. Turns out that they can find the fact that histamine can be methylated in other than histaminergic cells. And that's where the question mark in the astrocyte or one of the glial type cells. So here is the dynamic of it. Here's the diagram of it. Am I going too fast? I'll slow down if that's okay. So how many of you participated in the Passion Play or associated events? Anybody here? Very nice. Any of you go to it? Now, it was pretty, how rainy was it Sabbath morning? Pretty much of a down, steady downpour? Everything was inside? How'd they get it inside? You mean in the gym?
No, it was from the beginning to the Garden of Gethsemane. It was in HVAC.
Oh.
And then Pilate, the crucifixion, and the resurrection of all the gym. So they just went HVAC.
Well, how did they accommodate all the crowds then? I mean.
What do you mean?
Oh, so at 9:30 they had a group come through.
Yeah, it was all outside until.
Oh, outside until 12. I think it was outside until 12,
and they pulled all the animals inside and switched all the scenes to the inside.
And then from the they were inside for the rest of the time?
No, they were inside until
like 3. Oh, wow, okay.
And they went back outside because it cleared up totally
again.
It was gorgeous.
Really? Oh, very nice. Okay. All right. Well, they ran out of apples in the Passion tent. So I know, did you go to the tent? And was it, pretty crowded in there? And did everybody get, did you pick up some hot chocolate?
No, but I took an apple.
Ah, very nice. Yeah, at any rate. Okay, well, that's neither here nor there. We helped organize it, and other people executed it, because I was someplace else. All right, here we go. So histidine is transported in, and then it's made into histamine through the loss of carbon dioxide, and then stored in a vesicle, and then released, of course, by voltage-gated and calcium-gated actions or whatever. Histamine then is sitting in there in the cleft, synaptic cleft. Number 6 says that's probably a, let's see here, what's 6? It's feedback inhibition of synthesis, so there's a feedback inhibitor, a ligand. So it lands on this ligand, and it tells everything to slow down the synthesis and slow down the packaging of it. Then you go on. Then there, in the postsynaptic cleft, there's a variety of families of histamine receptors. And from what you, if you notice here, there apparently is no mechanism within the presynaptic cell or the postsynaptic cell to actually break down histamine. Apparently, in glial-type cells, according to this model, it's uptaken and broken down a couple different methods. Then I don't know if it's as recycled or if it's broken down even further. But they don't know. Notice the cellular location of steps 7 to 9 remains poorly understood. They know it's not in the presynaptic cleft. They can't find it very often, presynaptic cell. They can't find it very well in the postsynaptic. They do see it in the glial type cells, but it does seem odd that there's no breakdown processes in the neurons themselves. So I'm sure additional work is being done to try to see if they can find that. Histamine regulation. Let's see, how much do you have to fill in there? Let me see the next page. Histamine, okay. All right, so there is some things, and let me go down here, and I'll stop right here. So the H3 that you see there is talking about the receptors. Now, so there is an H3 autoreceptor. Again, what's the idea of an autoreceptor? It means it's the receptor on the cell that released the histamine, or it released the neurotransmitter. So anytime you talk about an autoreceptor, you're talking about some sort of regulatory protein that's on the cell that released the material. So H3, so the subclass of autoreceptor is called H3, and those receptors control the synthesis and release. And so that's what we saw on the previous diagram. Not surprisingly, H3 antagonists, those things which are bind but provide an inverse of the normal action, increases the firing of neurons and increases the release of histamine, which makes sense. H3 agonists, which means that it binds to the... It's not a histamine. It does bind to the histamine autoreceptor, but since it's an agonist, it provides the same behavior as the original neurotransmitter or the correct neurotransmitter. So H3 agonists produce opposite behavior. In other words, it reduces the firing of neurons and it reduces the release of histamine, as you might suspect an autoreceptor would for a neurotransmitter. There's some question that it may, in fact, regulate HDC activity. HDC activity. All right. All histamine receptors have been linked to G proteins, which means that it's likely that the second messenger is cyclic AMP. But it appears that each receptor can activate a variety of second messenger systems. And all those, and that could be cyclic AMP, it could be IP3, inositol phosphate, all those apparently act on calcium concentrations. So if you then look specifically at the receptor types, the H1 receptor, and this is related to the previous diagram that on the postsynaptic cell, there was an H1, an H2, and an H3. Just as a hint, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you were thinking that it's that cells could be either H1 or H2 or H3. Well, as it turns out, cells can have a combination of all three of those receptors, or two of those receptors, or even just one, as you might suspect. Most cells, however, have a combination of all three receptors. But based on the cell type, their response may be enhanced or reduced relative to some arbitrary normal. So in cell type A, H1 may provide an intense response, whereas binding to H2 and H3 might produce a less intense response. But in cell B, or C, or D, H1 may not produce an intense response. 2 would produce an intense response, and 3 not. So again, the tissue and the cell type all play an important role on the kind of receptor that you have on the surface and how that receptor responds to the ligand being present. So typically, however, you find that H1 stimulates glycogen metabolism and increases cyclic AMP levels. So here you see it also increases cyclic GMP levels. So it's not merely AMP that can be cyclic. You can have cyclic TMP, GMP, CMP. Not all of which have been studied. And then apparently, the H1 receptor, if it gets triggered, depolarizes some brain regions in the hypothalamus, thalamus, and cerebral cortex. Again, you have to understand that there are regions, not only cells, particular cells, but regions of nerve tissue that have particular bundles or particular varieties or combinations of receptors. And so like here it talks about the hypothalamus and thalamus, that receptor in that region of the brain slightly depolarizes the entire cell, which makes it, you know, less sensitive to other things. So, anyway, so the H2 receptor. Again, G protein linked. Apparently this is a cyclic AMP increase link. Cyclic AMP is thought to be linked to the outside, to be the link to the outside, the nervous system. Do you like how that's the French spelling of nervous. Do you like that? Actually, I don't think that's the French spelling of anything. I think it's just a big fat typo. But the nervous. I realized that last year and made a joke out of it. Or nervous.
Did you say that nervous is different from the nervous system?
I might have tried to say it, but it's actually, in fact, the same thing. It's just I typoed it. Just type it in. All right, anyway, H2 and H1 receptors help or hinder each other, so there is a yin and a yang to it. The presence of one and not the other, or the other and not the one. In some systems, H1 enhances H2 calcium signaling. In other systems, H1 and H2 apparently can contradict each other. Now then, prolonged histamine and H1 exposure leads to desensitization of the H1 receptor. Fortunately enough, H2 suffers the same fate. In other words, that the constant exposure of H1 or H2 to high levels of histamine cause the cell to reduce the number of histamine receptors made, reduce the amount of H1, H2 being made and located on the surface of the cell, or reduce the intensity of the response inside the cell to that particular stimulus. So the whole thing is downregulated through a variety of means. H3 receptor is an HT autoreceptor which inhibits histamine release, which you mentioned earlier, mediated through the calcium ion, maybe postsynaptic receptor in certain histaminergic cells. Cross out the receptors and put in cells. Histamine is likely to act on other sites than listed. Put an N right there. You will not need to memorize this table. Don't need to memorize it. But notice here, effectors. Here you got the IP3 or phosphatol inositate, phospholipase C system. You got your cyclic AMP system. They don't know what's going on with H3 in this particular textbook. They probably do now. Don't worry about this. The rest of it. And don't even worry about the whole table. Not going to ask any questions about that table. All right, page 6, ladies and gentlemen, of the handout. Skip all of this first stuff. Just don't even write it down. All right. Now, here is, again, the aspect that your brain is basically floating in a soup of neurotransmitters. All right? Your brain is basically floating in a soup of neurotransmitters. It's not a cream of tomato soup either. It's more like a stew of soup, a stew of neurotransmitters. Some locations in your brain have a higher concentration of neurotransmitters. Other locations here have less than that in a three-dimensional thing. This is why when you get to medical school or dental school and you ask about that, see if they have done any work on activity, areas of the brain get lit up during a PET scan. Does anybody know what a PET scan is? Tomography. Okay, everybody say positron emission tomography. I know you're writing this down, but you can say it aloud. Tomography. Tomography. Photography. Anyway, it's close. What's a positron? And how does it emit? Positron emission, they stimulate oxygen radioactively to make it a high-energy, unstable intermediate. Oxygen. Actually, is it oxygen 18? It may be oxygen 18, actually. They make it metastable. Is it M over here or is it M over here? I don't know where it is. Anyway, and so this unstable stuff eventually goes down and is stable, but it emits a positron. But it is elemental oxygen. It is elemental oxygen. And maybe I should just stop while you're writing this down, huh? Because you can't listen to two different things at the same time? Okay. I'll be quiet. Do, 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 do. How close is the time to being correct? 9:12. Okay, let me then go back. Okay, vibration mode is on already. Okay, good. Let's get ready to rumble. So, again, histamine neurotransmitters, other regulation. Again, you have this soup of things, and so histamine, the presence of this H3 receptor is inhibitory, reduces the amount of acetylcholine, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin released. There's some evidence that the presence of those other receptors and histamine increase the activity of the systems. Activation of certain selectors increase histamine release. That makes sense. In other words, that you can get a compound, release histamine. So here you go. It's a function of histamine in the central nervous system. It's a regulator of whole brain activity. Woohoo! So the fact that you're awake means that you have, and reasonably aware, means that you have a certain amount of histamine now generalized in your brain, especially in your frontal cortex, back here in the hypothalamus and other regions that deal with regulation of metabolism and so on, energy level. So wakefulness and arousal, H1 receptor in ventrolateral hypothalamus, we don't care about that. Maybe part of the sleep-wake cycle. If they can increase, let me just make sure I get this right. You have some other stuff to write in, but you've gotten this far, is that right? Okay, I need to talk about PET. A PET scan. Again, what does a PET stand for?
Positron emission tomography.
Tomography, that's correct. Now, it has to relate it to the fact that they take oxygen, I think it's oxygen 18. Oxygen is 18, isn't it? No, oxygen 16.
Yeah, but it's isotope.
Yeah, exactly. So they take an isotope of oxygen and have you drink a big bunch of it. Doink. And then, of course, that oxygen immediately transported through the circulatory system. Oxygen is related to metabolic activity. Metabolic activity. So they use this a lot for example, I mean, they do PET scans and they show young men pictures of scantily clad women. And they're analyzing the brain pattern, and they can see where their increased metabolism is in the brain when you see scantily clad pictures of women. Or you see... they've done a study with this, and they showed pictures of scantily clad women, and certain areas of the brain would light up, and then they give men a bunch of other kinds of stimuli to see if they get the same regions to light up, where it gets lit up, because where there's increased metabolic activity, oxygen use is concentrated there, so the oxygen flow is higher, and therefore the oxygen that's continually emitting, the radioactive oxygen continually emitting positrons, it begins to glow a little bit more. They can do this in a three-dimensional aspect and find three-dimensionally located in the brain where there's an increased oxygen concentration because of an increased positron emission at that point. Does that make sense? Okay, so guess what other stimulus in young males caused the exact same areas of the brain to light up as men looking at scantily clad women? You would think that not scantily clad men, even in homosexuals. What? Yes, but what kind of food? Anybody know? Probably not. Cinnamon rolls. The smell of cinnamon rolls, of cinnamon. A Cinnabon stimulates the exact same areas of the brain as a man looking at a scantily clad. I had to laugh. That's why I remember it. That's why I remember it. I mean, out of the millions of things that hit my brain all the time, that's what I remember, is that it was a cinnamon roll, or the smell of cinnamon and sugar and stuff like a cinnamon roll stimulated the brain in the exact same places as a man looking at a scallop. So when it says the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, that's absolutely true. And well, yeah, that's, you know, you're right. It has to do with, so just walk around with the ode to cinnamon, ode to cinnabon, and you'll have men following you with a heightened interest. And they're not sure why. You're fully clothed, but man, you're still really attractive. I don't understand. Oh, well, at any rate. All right, so where am I here? I mean, we'll get to this. And we're nearly done for the day. And so, okay. All right, so you can have the apparently higher levels for individuals who have certain types of seizures in which their brain misfires and they have muscle contractions, uncontrollable muscle movements, catatonic states and so on, it appears that high levels of histamine acting on the H1 can reduce that effect. And so there's been a lot of work trying to get anti-seizure drugs looking at that H1. H1 antagonists, that is, things that bind to it but induce the opposite behavior from normal, actually increase seizure. All right, hypothalamic regulator, vasopressin release regulated by histamine receptors. So this vasopressin, again, is a powerful short-term hormone, has enormous power in certain locations in the body. H1A2 acts on pituitary functions as well. Food and water intake, increased histamine concentrations, reduced food intake. This ventromedial hypothalamus, they're not really sure exactly what happens. Zuckerites have a genetically lowered histamine values, and they are obese. I think that's the kind of an interesting thing here. Genetically modified to be obese. And it appears to be pain relieving, and that they think some of that higher levels of histamine that are pain relieving, although everybody who has allergies knows that histamine is such a pain in the neck or other areas, but actually, apparently there is some pain amelioration with high levels of histamine in the central nervous system. I think that's it right then. So whatever. Well, this stuff really gets interesting right now. How far are we? Are we just... We only have a page, right? We have this page and then half a page next? Is that right? Okay. Well, listen, since we're so close to being completely done with this, why don't we go ahead and just finish this on Wednesday real quick, okay? We'll just finish all this. I'm not going to leave five more lines done. What I'll do is I'll make copies of the next page. It's mostly blank, isn't it, the next page? Yeah, okay. I'll just make copies of it so you don't have to write it in. We'll run through it real quick. This afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, people coming into lab, did you get a lab handout with a test? Okay, have you had a chance to look that over yet? Please look it over. We're going to take 2 weeks on it, but it's a fairly complicated lab, and we're going to try to make, we're going to start on the theory today. We may actually then work on theory today, and then actually do the lab next week on Monday. All right, any other questions about lab organization? I mean, class management issues and so on? Everything under control here? All right, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We will talk to you later. Have a great day and a better tomorrow.